Chapter 3. What? How? Whither? All God's servants are minutemen and women. As of old, I stand with sandals on and staff in hand, waiting for the watchword and the revelation of what, how, whither. Mary Baker Eddy, 1886. The dissident students did not attend the Sunday afternoon services at Chickering Hall, but the leader knew that they were not inactive in their efforts against her. Anticipating areas for troublemaking, she thought about the mortgage on the church lot, due and payable July 1, 1889. Late in November, Mrs. Eddy employed an attorney in Boston named Baxter E. Perry for the purpose of purchasing the mortgage for her, which he did on the 4th of December. Mrs. Eddy officiated at the church service on Sunday, December 23rd, although her Christmas sermon for that occasion, Miscellaneous Writings, page 161, was read by the assistant pastor, Frank Mason. Dr. Foster Eddy conducted a song service, and an original hymn by Mrs. Eddy was read. First published in the Lynn Transcript on December 2, 1876, as Hymn of Science, now 12 years later, slightly revised, it is called Communion Hymn of Christian Science. Saw ye my Savior? Heard ye the glad sound? Felt ye the power of her word? 'Twas the truth that made man free, and was found by you and me in the life and the love of our Lord. Mourner, she calls thee, come to my bosom. Love wipes the tears all away, and will lift the shades of gloom, and for thee make blessed room when the darkness hath yielded today. Sinner, she calls thee, daring or dying, oh, take my offering in, and the spirit that makes pure will exalt thee and will cure every sorrow and sickness and sin. Strongest deliverer, friend of the friendless, life of all being divine, thou the Christ and not the creeds, thou the science of good deeds, thou the water, the bread, and the wine. The predisposing cause. As 1888 drew to a close, the Church of Christ Scientist appeared to be prospering, with 50 new members admitted at the Christmas service, including Ira Oscar Knapp and his wife, Flavia Stickney Knapp. These loyal followers were not unaware of the persecution aimed at Mrs. Eddy's church. Many thought the trouble lay with the rebellious students, but the leader knew that the disloyal students were the victims of malicious mental malpractice, and she also knew when, how, and through whom that malpractice had begun. Without a malpractitioner, malpractice cannot operate. As the revelator to this age, she had been forced to expose the works of Richard Kennedy in the third edition of Science and Health. Her words, published in 1881, were just as applicable to the present situation. We now understand that never another of our students would have gone astray from the straight and narrow path, but for the continued mesmeric influence of that one, employed months and even years upon certain individuals whom he wished to turn away from Christian Science, until at last they yielded to the hidden agent and thought and did as he directed, and he boasted of his power over them. None of the students understood malpractice, nor how it started, nor the seriousness of the situation. She alone could see it, as was graphically depicted in a vision at the beginning of the new year. Vision of January 1st, 1889. She saw the house on fire, which seemed to commence in an L, and there was but one in the house, which was Miss Morgan. I commenced to cry fire with all my might. She said, I have been trying to put it out, but cannot do it. When I succeeded in calling help, they wanted to know what is the matter. I said, the house is on fire. But they could see no fire, and I could not make them see it. I also saw R.K., and he appeared very kind and talked with me. And when I spoke to him of the danger, he said, oh, that's all right, I'll attend to that. The leader related this vision to Calvin Fry, together with an explanation of the problems they were encountering. Mr. Fry recorded her words as follows. What is causing my suffering now? Richard Kennedy kindled the anger of Charles Cross and wife by telling them that I produce all their sufferings. He is also telling the same to Choate and his wife. What made such an aggravation of suffering Wednesday was Dr. Eddy took up that they must suffer for trying to make me suffer. Then both C's seized upon him with determined vengeance, and then me. They tried to put Mrs. C's beliefs onto me, told me that I suffered from Mr. Fry, and infuriated him to all his bad actions, told him he could not help himself or Mrs. Eddy, told Dr. Eddy that he brought back to her mind all the old images of anatomy, and thus made them seem real to her. They told Mr. Fry that he could not get help through God, tried to make him hate Dr. Foster Eddy, and both to hate Mrs. Eddy. This is the fire, anger, in the outbuildings that K kindled, and he is putting in other minds that he was not doing it. He told me there was no fire. This is the suffering by which I have to find out the C's anger, and that K was producing it. This is the suffering that I passed through in the vision to reach the fire, find out what was its cause, and to make my students know what it was and how to take it up. Take up the C's that Mrs. Eddy is not producing her suffering, but K is doing it, and telling them it is Mrs. Eddy. They cannot help her by taking up Mrs. Eddy, nor transfer her beliefs to Mrs. Eddy. Take up K, that he cannot do this. He cannot make others believe a lie. He has no faith in his own power to do this, and knows he must suffer for it. He will be publicly exposed, and he cannot make Mrs. Eddy or anyone else suffer for exposing his sin, for God will sustain them, and he cannot beat God. Mrs. Eddy, you cannot help yourself. You feel everybody's disease and state of mind. You are poisoned to death and cannot demonstrate Christian Science upon yourself. You cannot have any faith in God. You cannot get any help through Him. You cannot write, teach, lecture, or travel. You have got to die. You take everybody's disease and cannot get rid of it. You are perfectly helpless. You suffer for telling the truth about Kay. Dr. Foster Eddy, your old beliefs of anatomy, medicine, and disease are all back again, and Mrs. Eddy is suffering from it, and you cannot help her, and she cannot help herself. You do not like her, and she does not like you. You cannot see your way through God, and she does not help you to help Mrs. Eddy or yourself. Kay argues this way and always adds, you cannot get rid of animal passion. Mr. Fry, you cannot escape from animal passions. Mrs. Eddy cannot uplift you. You won't do anything right for the journal. You will neglect all Mrs. Eddy's business. You will do everything contrary to what she says and keep her suffering through you. Mrs. Eddy had been partially deceived by Richard Kennedy in the 70s, but she was so no longer. His appearance of kindness might fool others, but he could no longer hide his wicked deeds from her perceptive vision. She passed through much suffering before she understood malicious animal magnetism and its methods, and now the task before her was to open the eyes of her students that they might understand this seeming cause and how to meet it. She spoke plainly to Mr. Fry and Dr. Foster Eddy, and they thought they were working for and with their leader. However, there were times when they were more affected by the subtle lies and suggestions of the malpractitioner whispered into consciousness than by Mrs. Eddy's words of warning and wisdom. She often had to turn to God alone for strength and help. The record of one student who was roused by the leader's work is as follows. About the 22nd of January, Janet Coleman called at Mrs. Eddy's home. I remember going to see our leader one day. It was 6 years to a day since I studied with her. The night before, I had been struggling with a hard belief. I saw a mental picture of a dirty hand with a string tied to each finger. I saw the fingers move, and a scientist would jump at the end of the string. I heard a man chuckle and saw handwriting of two men. When I was in the hardest physical struggle, I heard a voice say, "When the enemy shall come in like a flood, then the Lord will lift up his standard against him." I was at once healed. The next day, I went up to see our leader. I made up my mind if it was something that I should tell her, that she would see me, and she did. She told me I had seen the working of malicious animal magnetism, and I saw the personality through whom it came, although I never had met them. The writing was correct for both, and she said the chuckle was like one of them. She said she wished that all of her students could see it as I had seen it. The same person's effort was to control all of our leader's students when possible. Thank God it isn't real. Our leader told me at this time always to remember that there was no personified good and no personified evil. Many people who called themselves Christian Scientists were jumping at the end of a string pulled by the malpractitioner, though most of them thought that Sarah Cross was directing their activities. Mrs. Cross had organized a publishing company to rival Mrs. Eddy's, and in January published the Boston Christian Scientist to rival the Christian Science Journal. Evidently, when she had left her position as manager of the journal, she had taken the names and addresses of all subscribers, for in January, journal subscribers received copies of this new periodical. The February journal stated that it was believed that their mailing list had been obtained dishonestly, and to return this periodical, which was published anonymously, to Sarah H. Cross. There was also in the February journal a lengthy review denouncing Ursula Justafield's book. The letter a student had written about the book had appeared in the journal the previous October. I recognize the same difference between Mrs. Justafield's lectures and your book that I do between the zeal of Saul and the zeal of Paul. Her lectures lack regeneration. She has not yet been to Damascus. Like the prodigal son, I return hungry to the parental house, science and health. When Mrs. Eddy had been displeased with Mrs. Justafield's Key to Science and Health, the latter had reacted bitterly and published a pamphlet entitled Jesuitism in Christian Science, which was a vilification of Mrs. Eddy's life and work. The leader answered this attack in the November journal, stating, "Though a Christian Scientist in name, she, Mrs. Justafield, is a member of the Theosophical Society in Chicago. The picture she draws of me is the subjective state of her own mind and the minds of members expelled from the Christian Scientist Association of Boston. The reader recognizes at once that it is no portraiture of the author of Science and Health. The honest seeker after Christian Science asks, where shall the young child be born? Where shall the human concept of the divine idea be given birth? He queries, is the mother of Science and Health a misnomer? Does the child look like its mother, act like her, and does it resemble in the least the hideous counterfeit that Mrs. Justafield has conjured up? My heart's desire is that the mind of this woman be imbued with better thoughts and her life uplifted." The scientists jumping at the bidding of the malpractitioners were a grave concern to the leader and her loyal followers. The main article in the February journal struck a blow at the cause of the problem. It was an article from Mrs. Eddy's pen entitled, "Malicious Animal Magnetism." One of the greatest crimes practiced in or known to the ages is mental assassination. A mind liberated from the beliefs of sense to do good by perverting its power becomes warped into the lines of evil without let or hindrance. A mind taught its power to touch other minds by the transference of thought for the ends of restoration from sickness, or, grandest of all, the reformation and almost transformation into the living image and likeness of God, this mind, by misusing its freedom, reaches the degree of total moral depravity. Does the community know this criminal? He sits at the friendly board and fireside. He goes to their places of worship. He takes his victim by the hand and all the time claims the power and carries the will to stab to the heart, to take character and life from this friend who gives him his hand in full trust and has perhaps toiled and suffered to benefit and bless him. What are some of the methods of this evil, this Satan let loose? What are some of the means through which these mental assassins affect their purposes? To alienate friends, to divide households, to make people sick and sinners, these are their common instrumentalities. Their methods of operation are to infuse silently into the thoughts of those they wish to use as instruments a false sense of the individual selected as their victim. Long acquaintance, tried fidelity, experiences that have knit hearts together, all become as nothing before these endeavors. The mind of the individual on whom they thus operate is filled with hatred of the dearest friend, is made incapable of a just judgment of this friend. Prior knowledge of him seems to be obscured, put out, annihilated, and a new image of thought to be created, one idea of individual character to be lost and another one formed in the mind of him whom they would cause to hate his friend. Mrs. Eddy wrote from many, many years of experience. All these things she had suffered at the hands of Richard Kennedy, beginning in the summer of 1871. It was 9 long years before she fully fathomed the methods of this wicked mental practice. And it was the summer of 1881 that she first exposed it in the 3rd edition of Science and Health. Her article on malicious animal magnetism continues. In this dilemma of thought, they get the audible falsehood into his mind, tell him how his friend has slandered him, is trying to injure him. If he is a scientist, they then say to him, Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones is preventing your success in healing patients, or is making your family sick. And the only way you can meet this is to take the case up and to treat your patients against Mrs. Jones' mental malpractice. If you can destroy your patient's fear of Mrs. Jones, or can choke her off by any means, however foul, you are conscientiously bound to do it. And of two evils, this is choosing the lesser. There may be 100 or more operators all set at work at this very job to kill Mrs. Jones, or to save their patients or themselves, according as the directing malevolence may dictate. The said Jones is all the while as unconscious of this conspiracy as the unborn babe. The mental assassins are morally responsible for the consequences, and God alone can save her life from the fatal effects of this malice aforethought of the first party and the culpable blindness of the second, whom they have misguided. When the work of the mental assassin culminates and the victim falls, the doctors are consulted and call it heart disease or some other visitation of God. And thus they try to carry the age along on their deceptions. This criminal practice, this wickedness in high places, has accumulated in subtlety of method until it culminates at this period in spiritual wickedness and poses its power to do evil against the spiritual power in Christian Science to demonstrate good. when first denounced by me from the housetops in Science and Health 13 years ago, the revelation was received with incredulity, with derision, with pity. Today, scientists are learning, and the general public is experiencing more and more the terrible realities of mental malpractice and assassination. It is no longer possible to keep still concerning these things. Nay, it is criminal to hold a silence and to cover a crime that grows bolder and picks off its victims as sharpshooters pick off the officers of an attacking force. These secret, heavy, defying enormities must be proclaimed, or we become guilty before God as accessory after the fact. If a friend were fallen upon and maltreated or murdered before our eyes, should we hold ourselves guiltless? Should we count ourselves men and women if we buried the secret of the violence and our knowledge of the assassins? Are we such cowards, knowing the facts that we do know, as to turn and run? Shall we see the evil, the deadly danger that threatens our brother, and to hide ourselves, flee away, not warning him? The science of mind uncovers to scientists secret sin, even more distinctly than so-called physical crimes are visible to the personal senses. Crime is always veiled in obscurity, but science fastens guilt upon its author through mind, with the certainty and directness of the eye of God Himself. Human laws will eventually be framed for these criminals that now go unwhipped of human justice. Human law even now recognizes crime as mental, for it seeks always the motive. Rude counterfeit, as it is of divine justice, it metes out punishment or pardons according as it finds or finds not the evil intent, the mental element. The time has come for instructing human justice so that these secret criminals shall tremble before the omnipotent finger that points them out to the human executioner. This is not an invitation to promiscuous denunciation. The time is not ripe for that. But God tells us now to uncover this wickedness, to expose its methods, to accumulate the evidences of its enormities. The human mind must be instructed by facts, taught how to recognize the signs of these secret crimes as they are worked on individuals, and also the method of self-protection, the antidotes found only in divine science. God has bidden me to uncover this wickedness, and I follow His voice. Let all scientists aid in this work, first by bringing out in their reports on the practice of healing careful statements of the facts of malicious animal magnetism that are daily passing before their eyes. I am not inviting them to indiscriminating condemnation, but to bring out such facts as have come within their own field of observation. I have put on paper enough to reveal criminal magnetism and to meet its developments for time to come, when my voice will be no longer heard. But God does not let us wait. He tells us to denounce now some of the crimes of malicious mind, and to teach as fully as the age can bear, And as the developments of this crime demand, its methods and their unfailing antidote. I will now answer some questions that correspondents have asked me concerning my teaching of and ways of dealing with malicious animal magnetism. One correspondent asks, "Do I teach the same with regard to mesmerism to all my students?" My answer is, I do, in substance, the same. The manner of expressing my thoughts may vary, but never the idea. Every student who has been through my class understands fully how to handle the ignorant animal magnetism, termed sickness, and latterly, I have taught as fully as God has allowed how to deal with the malicious element. He tells me now to meet its growing wickedness by fuller revelations. Do I approve of treating personally for malicious mesmerism the offending malpractitioner, even when the malpractitioner is attempting to kill someone and scientists know it? Shall they treat the offender personally? I answer, if they do treat thus, they prolong their own understanding. The altitude of Christian Science is omnipotence. Truth is given us for this purpose, to destroy error and make man free in the impersonal Christ. Do I employ students to do the work I have not the time to do? In other words, in trying to injure fellow beings. I could commit suicide sooner than do that. I have laid upon the altar too much for my fellow mortals to undo my life work and now turn to injure them. The very misguided ones, the deluded ones, who would constrain others to believe this for my hurt, know better. These deceivers are under a demonical spell. May God open their eyes and save them from future condemnation. Devastating effects. The last notice in the journal for February 1889 was headed Church Services, and it invited friends to send to the journal notices of all regular Sunday meetings, Scientist, giving the place and hour of meeting and nature of the service. Following the notice, two churches were listed, Mrs. Eddy's church in Boston and that of her zealous student in New York, Mrs. R.J. Augusta Stetson. Mrs. Eddy had sent a reluctant Augusta to New York City for the winter season in the fall of 1886 and again in the fall of 1887 to help establish the Christianity of Christian Science there. Mary Plunkett had invaded the city with her false teaching of Christian Science in 1887, and it was the winter of 1888 to 1889 that Mrs. Stetson really felt and assumed the total responsibility for the mission her leader had given her. Mr. John Campbell, the first practitioner in that area and one of the founders of the New York Church, defected and joined Mrs. Cross's rebel movement. Defections added to Mrs. Plunkett's false teaching threatened to overwhelm the scientists. The atmosphere was charged with malicious mental malpractice, which frightened the students of that day. Another founder of the church, an earnest young practitioner and teacher, Mr. F. D. Snyder, fell victim to the attacks and died quite suddenly. In this battle for survival, Augusta Stetson proved a staunch warrior. On February 14th, Mrs. Eddy notified Mrs. Stetson that she would come to New York to speak the next day. In that short time, Augusta made all the arrangements and gathered a sizable audience, including large press representation. Some newspaper reports were favorable and some were hostile, but this occasion gave Mrs. Stetson and her church much needed support. The March Journal had this to say: Reverend Mary B. G. Eddy lectured in New York City at Steinway Hall the evening of February 15th to an audience of over 1,000 persons who came together on a notice of only 24 hours. When she came on the stage, the audience greeted her by rising to their feet and standing till she was seated. Mrs. Eddy was escorted on the stage and presented to the audience by Reverend J.C. Ager, pastor of the New Jerusalem Church of Brooklyn. Mr. Ager said that while he could not pretend to be a student of Christian Science, he had been struck by its wide diffusion and by the fact that it took hold of and brought to the acknowledgement of Christ so many individuals that other forms of religious thought had failed to interest, that the stream that had its origin from Mrs. Eddy had, he believed, divided into many branches, some of which, he had been told, flowed through very muddy channels, but that in all its forms, it commanded the serious attention of all thoughtful observers as the most important modern religious movement. The lecturer, at the conclusion of Mr. Ager's remarks, discussed the questions: Is God the divine principle or a person? Is matter substance? Is materia medica a science? Does Christian Science tend to destroy the efficacy of the atonement? And in conclusion, Christian Science is the stranger within our gates. She was listened to with deepest attention, and in the most absolute silence to the end, when a round of hearty applause showed the appreciation of her listeners. Mrs. Eddy then withdrew to the dressing room, where the throng so pressed upon her that she was obliged to come out on the stage, and nearly an hour was passed in receiving the congratulations, thanks, and blessings of those who passed in succession to receive a grasp of the hand and a kindly word. Until now, Mary Plunkett had considered New York her exclusive territory. The press referred to her as the High Priestess of Christian Science, and Mrs. Stetson's infant church was little more than a thorn in her rose garden. But the leader's sudden appearance was something to be reckoned with. The High Priestess and many of her followers attended this lecture, much to the dismay of the sincere, loyal students. But even the renegades were moved by the leader's words, and all were lifted to new spiritual heights. The atmosphere was cleansed and purified, at least for the time being. Following the lecture, Mrs. Plunkett pushed her way through the crowd, grasped Mrs. Eddy's hand, and kissed her cheek. The journal called this the traitor's kiss, as well it might have been. It also stated, One journal speaks of the visit to New York of the discoverer and teacher of Christian Science as an invasion of the territory of a rival in Christian Science. Students who are incorrect in the letter and devoid of the Spirit speak soft words publicly of Christian Science, which they need for their traffic, but in their private lives and communications are its worst foes. Mrs. Eddy had announced the first Christian Science reading room in September, and in December had begun plans for missionary work through Christian Science dispensaries. But the bombastic Mary Plunkett threatened to outdistance the leader in these areas and on every other front. She proclaimed a broad platform for Christian Science practice and teaching, which attracted scores of persons just wakening to the science of being. And because there were no moral or spiritual demands and no restrictions of any kind, many of Mrs. Eddy's former students who had found the demands of the science of soul too great associated themselves with Mrs. Plunkett. This included Luther Marston, M.D., Albert Dorman, Arthur T. Buswell, Mr. and Mrs. Choate, Daniel H. Spofford, J. M. C. Murphy, Reverend Joseph Adams, Ursula Justifield, and many others. This false Christian Science teaching was running wild throughout the country and was aptly described at that time by the term wildcat, which the dictionary defined as incorrect, worthless, irresponsible, unsafe, said to have been originally applied to the notes of an insolvent bank in Michigan, upon which there was the figure of a panther. Mrs. Eddy's lecture at Steinway Hall was an attempt to stem the tide of this irresponsible teaching and practice. Mrs. Plunkett's organization was spread far and wide, but it was only darkening the name of Christian Science. For true Christian Science practice and teaching must be founded on the rock, not on the shifting sands of personality. Ironically, the students who were denouncing their forever teacher and true leader were claiming to have overcome personality. In their blindness, they accused Mrs. Eddy of all their own personality weaknesses. A sincere student wrote in the April Journal, "How would it strike us to hear a professed Christian say, 'Oh, yes, the Sermon on the Mount is of transcendent elevation and beauty, but Jesus was selfish, conceited, and aspiring'? Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Commune with the pure, uplifting, healing thought of science and health, and then, fresh from this communing, record the answers to the questions raised in this discussion. Who that has come near to her, who of all that have sat at her feet in the classroom, has not felt the deep spiritual wisdom, the peace that is from God, coming as from an overflowing fountain into his own life? Who that knows only a little of her wondrous life, that hidden from the world yet waits to be told, does not know how she has borne in silent, uncomplaining anguish the attacks of malice, has constantly done good to them that hated her, blessed them that cursed her, and prayed for them that despitefully used her? Shame on the student of Mary B.G. Eddy, who goes out from the hallowed influence of her presence and teaching to whisper small gossip in corners and talk about personality, or worse still, to write books and start so-called schools of Christian Science on poor memorizings and weak plagiarisms from the teacher that is betrayed and maligned. Betrayed and maligned, how true. After Mrs. Plunkett and Mrs. Hopkins had started their magazine and their colleges in 1886, Sarah Cross had written of those endeavors in the June 1887 journal. Beware of false teachers. Mrs. Plunkett and Mrs. Hopkins are traveling over the land, professedly teaching Christian Science, and deluding their victims with the thought that they possess it pure and simple. When they consider it to be for their advantage, they claim to be Reverend Mrs. Eddy's students, but otherwise they deny her teachings, or worse than that, they vilify her. And now Mrs. Cross was doing the same thing. Her Boston Christian Scientist totally ignored Mary Baker Eddy, as if she did not exist, as do almost all history books to this day. Would malicious mind turn every loyal student against the revelator to this age? One after another, her students had deserted her. As in her vision on November 11, 1888, her babe had been stripped naked. All of her organizational endeavors for promoting Christian Science were under attack. And it sometimes seemed that even with the loyal students who had rallied to her aid, they were on a sinking ship. But no, God was at the helm. He had directed her path thus far, and he could pilot the bark of Christian Science through these rough waters. Her task was to turn unreservedly to God for direction and to follow his guidance whithersoever it might lead.